Hey friends, I want to thank our sponsor, Raygun. Are you struggling to replicate the bugs and performance issues that your customers are reporting? Plug Raygun into your web and mobile applications right now and diagnose problems in minutes rather than hours. Kiss goodbye having to dig through log files and relying on frustrated users to report issues. Make your software development life so much easier using Raygun's error, crash, and performance monitoring tools. Every software team can create flawless software experiences for their customers with Raygun. Try it free today at raygun.com. That's RAYGUN.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselm, and this is another episode of Hanselm Minutes. Today I'm talking to Ayesha Mazumdar. She is a senior UX engineer at Optimizely. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Scott.
Yeah, this is cool. I'm excited to talk to you. So, I have talked about accessibility on the show before, right? And the whole idea when you're building a culture of inclusion is to avoid excluding anybody, right? And I think that we indirectly do that all the time when we make non-inclusive or non-accessible websites.
Yeah, absolutely.
You think lots of websites aren't accessible?
Oh, definitely. It's a moving target. You know, you can never have a website and say this is 100% accessible. But I think if you took an average of every site out there, we'd probably be in the 20%.
Yeesh.
Maybe that might even be generous.
So what does that mean, accessible, though? I mean, from a simplistic perspective as an able-bodied person, I guess when I think accessibility, I think alt tags on images. And I know that's awful of me.
That's one part of it. It's a very, very tiny part of it. The way I like to describe accessibility is essentially ensuring that everyone, no matter their level of ability, can interact with, add to, contribute to, and basically utilize every website the same way as everyone else, right? It should make no difference what you are able to do with any type of technology, no matter what the ability of your body is.
Okay. So simplistically, as I put it, I was thinking alt text, which is the obvious stuff, like I can't see that image, so I'll describe it to you. But if I was going to put a control on my page, like a date picker, I mean, how is that not accessible? Why can't everyone just pick a date?
Oh, you picked the one component that's my nightmare. Date pickers are challenging. They involve a lot of keyboard interaction, right? If you want to make a date picker accessible and you're not able to use a mouse, you want to be able to perform all the exact same functionality with a keyboard. And that means tabbing to the inputs, maybe using your arrow keys to cycle through the different days, having a way to select the day. All of that is very complicated interaction, but it's something that you want to make sure everyone can use. And that's the level that goes beyond just adding alt text to images.
Interesting. But then in a world of pretty React components and super cool JavaScript pop-down date calendar looking deals, why don't we just go back to drop-down lists? I mean, when the web started, you had a month, a day, and a year. They were drop-down lists, and I could use up and down and a tab. And I was ready to go.
Yeah, I think nowadays we want customization, right? We want to be able to make things look gorgeous and fancy. And we want our date picker to look different from everyone else's date picker. But the risk in that is, like you said, we are not using the standard out-of-the-box components anymore that were accessible by default. And instead, we're rolling our own versions. Mm. And by doing that, we risk creating 20,000 different date pickers, all of which are inaccessible.
I see. So in our quest for, UX consistency and really being attractive and innovative, we can easily make something that looks pretty and is clickable with a mouse, but falls apart pretty quickly when you start tabbing around and using arrow keys.
Absolutely. If you're not thinking about it very actively as you're developing that component, it can be very easy to create a completely inaccessible date picker or whatever it might be, drop down, menu, et cetera.
It does make me wonder, though, why companies that aren't in the business of making UI controls insist on making UI controls from scratch. We're an insurance company, and before we make insurance, let's make a new date control that no one's ever seen before.
I would say a lot of it just comes from maybe a little bit of a misconception that that's expected of you, you know, that when you are building out a company, or like you said, you're an insurance company that's not necessarily too concerned about the looks. I think there's still a misconception that, you know, as a design organization, maybe we need to be the ones to create this brand new version of this component that has existed elsewhere. But by making our own, maybe we get a chance to, you know, showcase our branding or put our individual flair on it, which sadly a lot of times comes at the cost of usability.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in a world though of componentization, I mean, the web is starting to allow us to make our own tags, our own components, where the behavior of the component is self-contained. I guess is that a good definition of what a component is? It's something self-contained?
Yeah, you can think of it as being encapsulated. Mm. You know, everything that the component is concerned about is encapsulated within that component. So outside stuff can't get in, the inside stuff can't bleed out. That's a good way of thinking about it.
Okay. So if I make a component that represents a date control, I should be able to do that in such a way where I get the accessibility correct, and then it works. It just works everywhere.
Yeah, that's definitely one thing that I've been trying to accomplish with our component library, which happens to be built in React, mm-hmm. is that ideally I would love for all of our developers to be able to pull out this date picker into their UI and not have to worry a single bit about whether or not it's accessible. I would love to get to the point where every component in our library is accessible by default and includes the keyboard interaction needed in order to make sure that when, you know, one of our developers on a feature team pulls it in, they don't have to put their time or effort into thinking about, is this date picker keyboard accessible? Does it work with a screen reader? They know that because of where it came from, it's going to be accessible already.
Mm, okay. So your components are in React, but you know, whoever's listening might have components in whatever world or language that they want to have. I understand that the W3C's Web Accessibility Initiative has this thing called ARIA, A-R-I-A, mm-hmm. Accessible Rich Internet Applications. Does that work with not just React, works with anything, any JavaScript-y widget?
Yeah, you can. It's actually more on the markup level. So no matter what JavaScript framework you're using, you can add those ARIA tags to your markup, the underlying markup that's powering the component. Mm. And that can definitely add more accessibility. The trick, though, I think a lot of the community has said that the best amount of ARIA is very little to no ARIA.
Really?
Because you can actually go very far the wrong way when you're overusing ARIA. For example, there's a tag called role. You can set the role using ARIA attributes, right? Mm-hmm. But if you are taking a div and you're adding role equals button, the question should really be, why am I not just using the button tag? Right? Mm. There are so many out-of-the-box elements that do exist in HTML, and those are the ones we want to be using. We should very rarely want to make use of stuff like role equals to kind of override the functionality of something that, you know, is already out there and is already accessible by default.
That brings up an interesting question in my mind then, that there was a time a few years ago where people were making, you know, custom componentry, and they would basically paint stuff on a div, and they would take a div or a span and they would just, you know, I don't know, like interactivize the thing. I'm hearing you say that we shouldn't go and do that. We should think about starting from a button or a list or a unordered list or something that is at its essence a core HTML element.
Yes, definitely. I had a college professor who called it dividus, this kind of mentality of making everything a div, right? Because it's what people are very familiar with. It generally works out of the box in a sense that it'll display what you want it to display. But one thing that I'm really trying to get all of our developer teams to realize is that your first question should always be, is there something that already exists that does this, right? Is there a button tag, an anchor tag, like you said, unordered lists, list items? Should we be utilizing those instead of going into this dividus world where everything is a div or a span? And we lose a lot of the out-of-the-box automatic semantics that HTML brings us.
That makes me wonder if there's if I should have the core control be hidden underneath it. Like I've also seen people do a thing where there's the JavaScript widget, there's the, you know, the really cool funky looking widget, and then there's the underlying three text boxes or the underlying hidden three list boxes. So you're trying to like have the best of both worlds, but you end up creating a parallel DOM, almost like one for the pretty stuff and one for the person who is looking at it with a reader.
Yeah, you see this a lot, I think most commonly in like checkbox toggles or even checkboxes. Some of those, you know, out of the box elements don't look the greatest if you just use them by themselves. And so I have seen that a lot where people will kind of create, like you said, a parallel DOM that you can style, but the underlying element is the original native element. And I think that's fine as long as you put in the effort to test it, right? Manually test it with your keyboard, with your screen reader. Does the functionality still work? Are you overriding the default functionality or completely missing it just by creating this parallel DOM? Or are you still taking advantage of the underlying checkbox? You're just using this extra layer to style it, you know, according to your design system or your brand guidelines.
You know, and that actually brings me to kind of my core question and what I think would be a good title for this show, which is building out an accessibility culture from zero. Because what you're describing isn't technical problems, it's organizational willpower, where someone needs to decide that testing that is important and speccing it out is important.
Yeah, exactly. A huge part from what I've experienced of building accessibility culture is getting people into the mindset that, you know, writing a few JavaScript tests and making sure you can click around is not enough. Not if you want to ensure that what you're producing is accessible for everyone to use. There's, you know, screen reader testing. You need to make sure it's keyboard navigable. Can you tell where your focus is at all times? And I completely understand that people don't know this is something they should be doing. I mean, I went through 4 years of a computer science degree and never heard the word accessibility used in all four years. Yeah, it wasn't until I started my first job at Salesforce where I was building out a prototype and someone asked me if I had checked with the accessibility team about whether something I had built would be accessible. And I kind of gave them this really blank stare like, what's an accessibility team? I was so embarrassed that I had never even heard this word before, much less like knew what to do about it.
That actually kind of brings up the larger problem about accessibility culture. If one can make it all the way through school and never hear about that, what else are they not teaching us?
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of scary to think about. I mean, I'm sure none of my professors were aiming to exclude this huge group of people, right? They didn't want us to build, you know, whatever fake app we made and have it be inaccessible. I just don't know that at the time that I was in school, at least, that it was a valued lesson, you know, or even if they knew how important it would be to those people graduating and once they actually got into a company, that they would be asked about this. I don't know if maybe there's a disconnect between what the professors are teaching and what front-end developers are expected of once they join a company.
I wonder also when we're trying to bake that culture into a company, if, you know, going with the able-bodied argument or not is necessarily the best way, because keyboard navigation is helpful for everyone. Like your first time you visit a site, you might, or an app, you might end up using a mouse. But after a while, I'm going to start learning hotkeys. And if I have good keyboard navigation and then I extend that keyboard navigation up into hotkeys and shortcuts, and, you know, I really love it. You know, when you go to a website and you hit the question mark and it pops up like a, here are the hotkeys on this website. Like people don't even know that exists on GitHub. There's like a whole rich hotkey thing. It's amazing. Like what? You know, Gmail, Outlook all have these really cool things. Maybe one could sell it to the organization saying, look how much more productive our users of all flavors are because of our keyboard navigation.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's also a huge misconception that assistive technology is only benefiting a small portion of the population, right? It's absolutely not true. It benefits every one of us. We have all used some kind of assistive technology, whether that's in the physical world and it's using a ramp when you have suitcases. I mean, everyone's done that, right? Or if it's in the digital world, like you said, using keyboard shortcuts or even just tabbing through a form, right? That's using keyboard navigation. I do that all the time. And I find it really frustrating when it doesn't work. And that's for me, right? I can't imagine how that feels for someone who absolutely needs to use the keyboard. And so I definitely think there's a huge amount of education that needs to happen around, you know, this is for everyone. Assistive technology benefits absolutely everyone.
Indeed. The tabbing and having the tab jump off somewhere and realize that no one ever looked at tab stops is a mental speed bump for everyone.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Or the opposite that I've seen a lot, not the opposite, but a similar thing I've seen a lot is focus, right? A lot of people have this, that, you know, that like automatic blue outline that shows from browsers whenever you focus on something. Mm-hmm. The most common thing I see is resetting that, right? So people will say, you know, button outline none, which is fine. Ooh. I get that the blue, you know, border is not the prettiest, but you can't just take it off without adding something back in place of it. So I find that all the time people have taken off the automatic focus ring, which again comes out of the box with browsers, right? It requires zero work. Mm-hmm. It took more effort to take it off, but then you need to add on a little bit more effort to put it back on in a way that you like, you know, whether that's underlines or a different color of highlight or something, it needs to be there.
Does your dashboard design engage users and set your product apart? According to the analyst firm Gartner, the look and feel of embedded analytics has a direct impact on how end users perceive your application. Fortunately, you don't need to be a professional designer to turn flat information into rich visualizations. Logi Analytics has compiled 17 design tips that will transform your dashboards. Logi Analytics is the leading development platform for embedded dashboards and reports, and unlike other solutions, Logi gives you complete control to create your own unique analytics experience. Visit Logi Analytics, that's L-O-G-I, analytics.com/Hanselminutes to access 17 easy changes that will transform your dashboards. That's L-O-G-I, analytics.com/Hanselminutes. That actually, talking about this from the goal of baking it into the culture, rather than doing things like turning off those focus rings, as an example, baking it into the culture such that you say, okay, this is a thing, focus rings exist. How can we make it fit with our aesthetic without removing it? Like an acknowledgement that this is a required element. You know, links are underlined here. We don't change them all to be not underlined and not turn blue and purple. We need to work within these constraints.
Yeah, I think that's where design systems come in handy a lot of times, is mm-hmm. that you can set that at an organizational level, right? You can say, okay, here at Optimizely, all of our underlines or all of our links are going to have underlines and are going to be a certain color. And on hover and on focus, they're going to change this way to show that they are hovered or focused, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's a huge benefit of design systems because that's also part of the culture of the company. You can look at a company's design system, something I love doing. You can look at any company's design system and get a sense of what they value, right? You can look at their components and see, are they paying attention to accessibility? Are they calling out the keyboard interaction needed? Have they set a standard for all of their links, all of their buttons? Have they also set a standard for the different states, how they look in, you know, focus versus hover versus disabled, et cetera? I think that's part of my goal here, Optimizely, and I hope it's part of everyone's goal whenever they're building out component libraries and design systems, that by doing so, you're baking into the culture of the company an active, conscious commitment to accessibility.
Can you talk about the relationship or the difference between design systems and mm-hmm. component libraries?
Yeah, so design systems are kind of the broader aspect, I guess, if you want to say that. And component libraries are one piece of that. So oftentimes a design system can involve, you know, usage guidelines. It can involve color guidelines. One piece of it might be the component library. There's usually plenty of documentation around how to use the actual components. And a huge part that I always look for is that accessibility guidelines section, right? How are they ensuring that people who consume either the component library or, you know, maybe it's the content of your site, right? Not everything from an accessibility standpoint is actually technical. Sometimes it's, you know, how wide do you make your content? It's a lot easier for people to read in a narrow column than it is to read across an entire laptop screen, especially if they have, you know, maybe a mental or cognitive disability that prevents it from being very easy to read long paragraphs of text that span wide areas. And so I think that design system can include the component library, but also lots of documentation around how do we make this usable and not just accessible.
One of the things that you talk about in your presentation, scaling accessibility, is one of the great things about component libraries is that when you make a change, the whole ecosystem, you know, gets it. All the consumers get the benefit. But then you also point out that that's exactly what's wrong with component libraries.
Yeah, exactly. It's a double-edged sword. It can be very lucrative and it can be very efficient in scaling accessibility fixes, right? Like recently, I can fix the focus state of our inputs. And now in our application, every single input has a much better focus state. We've brought back a better blue focus ring. But same way, right? Some developer or someone else contributing tomorrow could accidentally remove that focus state and suddenly every input in our application won't have a focus state anymore. And so it's definitely a very careful balance between who has the ability to make changes, how are you testing visually, especially to make sure that you're not degrading the experience. But I still absolutely think component libraries are insanely helpful to any organization because you do get the ability to scale these changes and make one fix in one place and see it propagate throughout the entire application.
So you break it down with the eye towards an accessibility win into kind of three main categories: visuals, screen readers, and keyboard navigation. The obvious thing that I think that component libraries offer quickly and easily is visuals and consistency, right? So then there's some problem areas that happen in the visual space.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's very easy to come across contrast issues without even thinking about it, right? A lot of the components that you might build will have an option to specify the color or, you know, change something about what style text is being used. Is it gray text or black text? And I think that can definitely introduce a lot of issues around contrast. And so one of the things I talk about in that talk is, you know, taking advantage of something like React prop types to limit what the user can actually supply as a color to that component. And that's, again, it's the beauty of component libraries. It's your chance to give just enough control to developers to be able to use that component in multiple spaces. But you can also limit it the right amount to prevent any accidents, right? We don't want people to unknowingly create accessibility issues.
And if you go and solve these problems for everyone, you know, in one place, you solve them for everyone. You know, if your buttons in your component library get their focus and hover states right, then that can flow through and almost cascade into other other components.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I definitely recommend focusing when you are, you know, in this process of building out an accessibility culture and you're looking at your component library. I think it's very daunting. I mean, when I came into Optimizely, we had, I want to say it's at least 75, 80 components. And looking at that whole list and trying to think, okay, where do I start, right? Out of all of these components, what do I make accessible first? And I think I mentioned this in my talk as well. I took a look and saw, you know, which components are used the most often and which are the kind of base underlying components that propel a lot of other components forward. So buttons, inputs, links, a lot of that stuff is A, used all over the place in our application, and B, powers a lot of other larger components that are grouped together of these buttons and inputs, like a date picker. Date picker is a perfect example. And so by making sure that the inputs and the buttons are accessible, I can at least get a little bit further on the date picker.
Another example I thought was good in your presentation was the discussion of dropdowns. I see a lot of people custom creating dropdowns where there's like the text box looking thing with the chevron that points down, and then you click it and then the menu pops open, and maybe they paint the whole thing from scratch. Now, you had said at the beginning that the best ARIA stuff is minimal ARIA, but ARIA has these concepts of like expanded. Is this menu open or not? Is it a pop-up or not? When you set those, what does that really mean? Is that helping a screen reader? Does that automatically set up keyboard bindings? What do I get when I go and fill out those ARIA properties?
Yeah, so there's probably a misconception that setting those ARIA properties automatically gives you keyboard interaction, which is not the case. It is mainly helping screen readers. So for something like a dropdown, when you say ARIA expanded or you're telling the dropdown what is the current active descendant, like what is my fake focus on, that's all information to the screen reader to let it know what's happening right behind the scenes, which item is getting the faux focus, is your menu open or not, right? And so sadly it's not a magical out of the box answer that adding ARIA properties will make it completely keyboard accessible. That's a whole nother level of work that does need to be done, right? You have to tell it, you know, you have to tell the component to listen for the up and down arrow keys and ensure that you are setting that faux focus, the active descendant, properly, depending on if people are going up or down with the arrow keys.
Is there guidance on how these interactions should be? Because just as we as sighted people go and see a calendar and we figure out what to click on, because it generally looks like a calendar, I wonder if there's an agreement amongst date pickers or list pickers that like pushing down should pop the drop down open, or maybe you push Alt and down, or does someone have to learn that with every single site that they go to?
Well, from the developer side, if you are developing these components from scratch, you'll probably need to do the work to learn what the expected interaction is. But that expected interaction is pretty standardized. WCAG mentions it. There are plenty of other sites that will kind of give you these really nice guides to, you know, how to interact with a dropdown, how to interact with a date picker.
So that's authoring practices.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So you as a developer will need to figure out, like, you shouldn't be reinventing the wheel or inventing a square when it should be a wheel, right? You want to make sure you are keeping with the consistent pattern, because people who are using keyboards to interact with a site or using the screen reader are going to have a mentality of how it should be behaving, right? And you don't want to break that pattern. It's kind of going along this line too of, you know, just because it's accessible doesn't mean it's usable and vice versa, right? So you definitely want to make sure you cover both sides of that. Can I use it with the keyboard? Is it accessible that way? But am I also matching, you know, screen reader users' expectations so that it's still usable?
And is it usable via touch? So often I find people focus so much on keyboard and mouse, and then they find that an item isn't even touchable.
Yeah, tap targets are a huge issue, right? We use button icons all the time, everywhere. And then I've had it happen to me multiple times. I'm sure it's happened to you as well, where you pull up a site on your phone and you can't ever actually click on the thing you want to click on. It keeps clicking on something else, right? That's a huge issue. And it's a usability issue and it's an accessibility issue.
How do I talk my bosses down from them thinking that by bringing up these issues of accessibility, of keyboards, of, you know, even the small things around accessibility, keyboard accessibility, it's going to then, you know, increase the budget and it's going to double the amount of time that we're going to spend on this thing? How do I keep them from just saying no?
Yeah, that's the magic question, right? My experience so far has been reminding people what the negative effects are if we don't invest in this. So I recently gave a presentation to our entire company and, you know, tried to point out that if our tool isn't accessible, first off, we are limiting who can work at Optimizely, right? If it would be very hard to work here as a developer if the product itself were not accessible and you weren't able to develop our product. The other side of that, though, is I think this is where a lot of B2B companies kind of lose sight. You know, if you're a B2C company, it's a lot easier to say, okay, if, you know, Gmail is not accessible, millions and billions of people are not able to use it, right? Mm-hmm. But from an Optimizely standpoint, we're kind of separated from the end user. So there's this middleman, which is our, you know, our customers, and they're the ones who have people using the tool. So if our tool is not accessible, we actually have a ripple effect, right? We are limiting who can work at our customers' companies and who can be successful there. And I think that was kind of a key aha moment for a lot of people where they realized, you know, it doesn't just affect us. We have to be selfless and not worry about, oh, it only matters who we can hire. We are also affecting who our customers can hire mm-hmm. and who can be successful at those jobs. I think it's a common reminder. People need a reminder that this is bigger than themselves and affects a lot more than just a small percentage of the population.
Yeah, I feel like the ripple effect is that's the strategy, right? That do it wrong here, do it wrong as a component library, do it wrong as a platform company that sells your platform to other companies. And the ripple effect is going to be not just exclusionary, but it's going to just simply prevent people from being successful on your platform. So it's got to be a user story. It's got to be a line item. It's got to be fundamental.
Yes, absolutely. I would love to get to the point where it's treated like testing, right? No developer ever feels like they could check in code without writing tests. I would love to get to the point where developers never feel like they could check something in without it being accessible too. That takes time, obviously. It has to be integrated into the culture, integrated into the workflow. You know, we need our QA team to be testing for accessibility as well. But I have a lot of faith that it'll happen.
I appreciate that. I feel like there's an organizational maturity model, though. Like when you said, well, yeah, it should just be like checking in tests. I'm sure someone listening to the show winced and was like, oh, we haven't gotten there. We're not checking in tests yet or whatever.
I absolutely appreciate that at certain times you're not able to dedicate the energy to this, right? There's a lot of stuff that you need to get going first before you can even think about, maybe even think about tests, much less accessibility tests. Mm-hmm. But from what I've experienced, it is so much harder to put it in after the fact, right? One of my old coworkers who's does amazing talks with the community around accessibility, Cordelia, she has this analogy where it's putting accessibility in after is like trying to put the blueberries in a blueberry muffin after you've baked it. Right? It's like virtually impossible. You're going to squish the blueberries. They're not going to be throughout the whole muffin. It's not going to end well. And so that's always my kind of warning to people who are in that early stage where they're making the conscious effort not to introduce accessibility then because they have other things to worry about. And I think as much as possible, even if it's little things, right? Like thinking about the focus state of your buttons and your links and your inputs, which are like 90% of applications most of the time, mm-hmm. at least think about that. Because if you have to go back after the fact and try to bake the accessibility in after, it's just not going to end well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to make sure that we put links in the show notes to your talk at React Boston on scaling accessibility. And folks can communicate with you on Twitter. And they can check out your products at optimizely.com. Thank you so much, Ayesha Mazumdar, for chatting with me today.
Thanks so much, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.